Thank you, Your Honor. The district court correctly affirmed the Indiana Supreme Court's adjudication of petitioner's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Initially, I would just like to say that I agree with petitioner's counsel that the trial counsel here knew essentially what Dr. Lennon's testimony was going to be. And one thing I think that was overlooked here is that trial counsel does state in the post-conviction hearings that he had an opportunity to sit down and talk to Dr. Lennon about what his testimony was going to be before he testified, and indeed he did have the report.
Could I ask you something, Mr. Martin? You're familiar with the Daubert. I don't know if Indiana follows Daubert or not, but you're familiar with the
qualifications for
criteria.
Scientific testimony.
And one of them is the testimony is the product of reliable principles and methods, as the federal rules of evidence put it. Are you comfortable saying that that's true of Dr. Lennon? I'm just curious. I mean, it's not like a direct question since it's a step along the way toward a thought, but if you don't think there's mental illness, how can you be an expert on mental illness? I mean, there are all these criteria. You've probably looked at lots of reports from psychologists and psychiatrists. There are letters and numbers and categories, and they'll put you in this if you're bipolar, and they'll put you in that if you're something else. And here's a guy who doesn't think that there is anything. Do you think that that person would survive had it been a witness that you had wanted to put on, a Daubert kind of challenge?
Your Honor, with respect to a Daubert challenge, and forgive me for not being very well-versed on the actual requirements of Daubert at this time, but as I recall,
the product, well, I just read it to you for, as phrased in the federal rules, the product of reliable methods, reliable testing. Is this something that people in the profession regard as the right way to go about a project?
Your Honor, I think in terms of the evaluation of the petitioner, Dr. Lennon followed fairly routine procedures.
No, he didn't. He didn't use any of the diagnostic criteria. He didn't at all, in terms of diagnosis, do what any psychologist or psychiatrist would do.
No, I agree, Your Honor, that the diagnosis...
Well, and that's what he's being asked to do, after all. So I'm a little worried at the thought that the lawyers don't know that if you want somebody to diagnose mental illness, somebody who comes up and says, I don't think there is mental illness, is that person?
Well, in his testimony, Dr. Lennon did reference DSM-4 descriptions and qualifications for certain diagnoses. He, however, is somewhat of a pioneer
in
this bonding
and
attachment.
He might as well be an astrologist, it seems to me.
I think he's definitely an outlier in the mainstream of thought.
Right, and if you then had... Suppose he had come up with a different story that the state hadn't liked, you know, that whatever, some story that would have exonerated Mr. Stevens, and you had made a challenge to his qualifications as an expert. Don't you think it would have been a very strong challenge? You would have said, this guy doesn't represent anyone responsible in the psychiatric or psychological community.
I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor. I do understand that he has a rather unusual way of looking at persons that he deems at risk that are referred to him in that sense.
But that's, you know, that's already troubling, because if he's not willing to give a diagnosis, if he's not willing to say somebody's bipolar or somebody's suffering from depression or somebody has, you know, a dissociative disorder, maybe for all we know he's never heard of them. I mean, this is not somebody that can do the job.
Oh, Your Honor, I think he had extensive psychiatric qualifications and experience. He just had some different theories.
Well, that's the whole point, though. You can be the most... Look, this court at one point decided that a Nobel Prize-winning economist had not given competent testimony on economics in a case, and it had nothing to do with the man's background. He'd won the Nobel Prize. That's pretty good in economics. And yet, he had not applied that expertise in a way that was reasonable for that case.
I think it was reasonable in this case, Your Honor, though, because what trial counsels wanted to do was show the jury, and this is expressly testified to in the post-conviction proceedings by trial counsel. Their theory was that, and this is related also to the manslaughter defense, their theory was
that frivolous manslaughter defense, according to the Indiana Supreme Court the first time around.
Well, on direct appeal, Your Honor, the Indiana Supreme Court suggested that the manslaughter instruction might properly have been given had it not been for the time that they felt was a cooling off period between the initial attempts to suffocate Zachary Snyder and the ultimate tying of the trash bag around his
but
head.
Why does that mean that their bottom line was it was a frivolous defense on the basis of the facts in this record?
Your Honor, it was the best defense that trial counsels could come up with.
Well, because they didn't have a decent, look at the testimony of Drs. Kaplan and Coons.
Drs. Kaplan and Coons would have, had they been used, tried to convince the jury that Mr. Stevens was suffering from some kind of an out-of-body experience.
Right,
at the
a dissociative disorder, which they describe.
And Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that there is not a viable dissociative disorder diagnosis that can be made.
Okay, so you agree that there is such a thing.
Oh, certainly, Your Honor, certainly.
Mental illness.
But with respect to the facts of this case, they would have been in the position of urging the jury to believe that Mr. Stevens was suffering from a dissociative episode that spanned the entire time of these repeated attempts to kill Zachary Snyder, and or that he intermittently experienced dissociative episodes.
Why? What's so crazy about that? Certainly nothing worse than putting somebody in your lap and hugging them with a bottle.
Your Honor, and Dr. Lennon's expressions to that effect are certainly difficult to defend, but the point of his testimony was that Mr. Stevens did not have the capacity to act with a conscience or to act rationally and make good decisions in situations where he's stressed or when he's under duress. And that was because of his deprived and his unnurtured childhood and
background.
Well, and
his rapes and so on.
And
we don't need to minimize his background.
And his background, or rather, Dr. Lennon's testimony to this effect fairly well tracks petitioner's own expert at post-conviction, Ms. Burks, who worked with the Family and Marital Relations facility that dealt with people that were sometimes court-referred. But the point is, Your Honor, had the jury been asked to accept this, they would have had to accept it in the face of, for instance, an example I'd like to point out to the court's attention is that Dr. Coons at post-conviction explained during his testimony while viewing a videotape of the petitioner's confession instances where he said, yes, I believe he's dissociating there, where petitioner was urged to
right.
continue.
I know.
And at those points, I'm sorry, let me regain that.
Let me go back, maybe you can recall your train of thought, because I think, to me, it's very important as we consider, and I think you're arguing about prejudice right now, prejudice at the guilt or innocence phase of this trial versus prejudice at the sentencing phase of this proceeding. Because, maybe you're right. Maybe at the guilt or innocence phase, the jury would have thought these dissociative episodes aren't enough. He still had enough control. We're going to convict. I think the thing that worries me the most is the sentencing phase, where the standard isn't, would he have surely not gotten the death penalty? Is there a reasonable probability that the right kind of evidence, not Dr. Lennon, but instead a competent psychologist in the mainstream, would have made a difference? Does it undermine one's confidence in the outcome, as Strickland puts it? And I think at the sentencing phase, that's a very serious question, given that Indiana recognizes mental illness as a mitigator.
And indeed they do. And with respect to the distinction between asking for a guilty but mentally ill verdict in the guilt phase or asking for consideration of the mental health mitigators in the penalty phase, Your Honor, doing the former as opposed to the latter or doing the former in conjunction with the latter is simply front-loading your penalty phase argument.
Yeah, I was actually just sort of putting the guilt phase off to one side, but that's fine. You can
And the reason why they didn't do that was because they didn't want the damaging evidence. Trial counsel specifically stated that he wanted to keep any events or experiences that Stevens had had prior to the age of 18 out of the jury's consideration during the guilt phase. And would
why
therefore...
Why is that responsible, considering the grotesque nature of the evidence that's coming in? What is there to lose about letting any other evidence in about this man's terrible earlier life?
Because at that point, Your Honor, they were still hoping that they would get a voluntary manslaughter instruction and that the jury would possibly find that Mr. Stevens had not acted in a premeditated way, which would then prepare them for the evidence that they would hear in the penalty phase, which would show the horrendous childhood. And
you really think a responsible lawyer, I mean, it really seems like a kind of pie-in-the-sky strategy, if I can even call it a strategy, sort of a toss at the dartboard.
Your Honor, what I think is that it would have been insulting to the jury to present Dr. Coons and Dr. Kaplan's theories when applied to this petitioner under these
You're
facts.
Kidding. And it wasn't insulting to the jury to put Dr. Lennon on? Quote, Dr., close quote, Lennon?
Dr. Lennon was effective, at the very least, Your Honor, in conveying to the jury the kinds of problems that petitioner had dealt with growing up and how that typically would affect youths that had experienced similar things. Because he had a great deal of experience in that area. And had
How do you know he was effective? I mean, they voted to convict him and to give him death. You know, what would you think ineffective would be?
Well, Your Honor, I think under these facts, it wouldn't have mattered whether they would have presented Dr. Coons and Kaplan or Dr. Lennon. I think that they still would have recommended death.
So Dr. Lennon wasn't effective, but you don't think anybody else could have been effective either.
I think Dr. Lennon was a reasonable choice of a way to proceed in the penalty phase to the exclusion of Dr. Kaplan and Dr.
But what did Dr. Can you name me one thing that Dr. Lennon said that was helpful to Mr. Stevens? I can find lots of things that make me think Dr. Lennon was your witness, but I certainly can't find much that he said that helped his client.
Well, at one point, Dr. Lennon said, so much of the petitioner's behavior could be explained by the abuse, the neglect he's had on top of his genetic predisposition, and when you look at the drugs that his mother had done and that he concluded that his mother had done while she was carrying Mr. Stevens to term, the petitioner never had a chance to empathize with other people, never learned how to trust other people, and just didn't function using the same modes of conscience and reflection and interaction with people. He just was not able to learn how to do that at a critical time in his life when he was supposed to bond and learn how to do that. And I realize that Dr. Lennon's methodologies when he treats people, as he described in his testimony, are unorthodox.
Putting somebody in your lap and sticking a bottle in their mouth, yes. What about Lennon's testimony that Stevens has antisocial qualities and characteristics and tendencies, that he's not a good candidate for traditional types of psychotherapy, that he's a serious danger to society, there's every reason to believe he would continue to molest children if given another opportunity, and so on. This is the defense witness?
Your Honor, I realize that that kind of testimony runs a risk of prejudicing the jury.
And the lawyers knew he was going to say it, as you pointed out yourself, because it was all in the report, and yet they put him on. Why didn't they just leave him off the stand?
Because I think they wanted the jury to hear a professional discuss the effects of his background.
But look, why do they want the jury to hear that stuff that I just read off? I mean, they know what Lennon is going to say, and they put him on anyway.
I believe because they felt that they would be able to rehabilitate that testimony.
Do you think that? I mean, you don't think that.
I think if I were defense counsel, Your Honor, would I want some of those statements to have been made? No. But Dr. Lennon was giving an honest assessment, I think, that acknowledged the horrific circumstances of the crime. There was no evidence, or rather, I think it would be an unreasonable inference from the evidence in total, to assume that Mr. Stevens did not understand what he was doing, did not do so in a self-directed manner.
Well, look, I just want to be clear. I don't think Dr. Lennon was being dishonest at all. I mean, this is about whether the lawyers were smart, given the report in front of them, to use Dr. Lennon as a testifying witness as opposed to as a consultant, all discovery rules, including those in Indiana, distinguished between testifying experts and non-testifying consultants. And once they knew what Dr. Lennon was going to say, the fact that they didn't move him over into the non-testifying side is pretty stunning.
Well, Your Honor, I think that they thought they would be able to present some persuasive testimony to the jury that would preserve credibility before the jury and explain to them that petitioner simply did not possess the capacity to conduct himself appropriately at the time when he committed the murders. It was a sudden, unanticipated killing rather than something that he reflected upon and then did.
Mr. Martin, could I ask you a fairly technical question involving Indiana law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Help me with it. With respect to the report, when would there be an obligation on the part of the defense team to make the report available to the prosecution? Is that only if the witness actually testifies, or is it simply if the report comes into existence, whether or not the witness testifies?
My understanding of the law, Your Honor, is that it would be something that would be required to be turned over to the state, regardless of whether the witness was going to testify. And
now,
in this case,
does it make any difference who was paying, whether or not is a witness obtained by state funds or not by state funds?
I don't know, honestly, Your Honor.
On that point, I wondered about that. But Indiana Trial Rule 26B4B says, it draws that distinction between facts known or opinions held by an expert who's been retained or specially employed and who is not expected to be called as a witness or trial. You only get things on a showing of exceptional circumstances, whereas things to be used at trial you, of course, turn over to the other side. So that's the Indiana rule. It's not a federal rule.
And, Your Honor, I cannot gainsay you on that, and you're reading it right there. That may be the distinction.
It's a big distinction because I had the same question Judge Ripple had about whether consistently with the requirements, professional and otherwise, under the Indiana rules, if these lawyers had decided not to use Lennon as a testifying expert, would they have been entitled to keep his report? And, of course, you would report that you would indicate the report exists, and if the state wanted to try to make that showing of exceptional circumstances, it would be entitled to do so. It's not like you keep it a secret, but you don't have to turn it over.
And I understand that Your Honor's observation goes to whether it would have been better not to present Dr. Lennon at all.
And at least maintain some chance of keeping this very damaging report out of the hands of the prosecution.
And Your Honor, I would still say that given the judgment call that they were required to make, it was a reasonable strategy for them to present Dr. Lennon's testimony. The fact that Dr. Lennon's testimony did not go well in certain respects is kind of looking at it through hindsight. But at the same time, the bottom line is that had they not presented Dr. Lennon's testimony, had the report not come into evidence, and they heard the evidence from other witnesses about the problems, problems is an understatement, in Mr. Stevens' background and his development, it still wouldn't have caused a reasonable probability that they wouldn't have recommended a sentence of death. And I think that the Indiana Supreme Court's conclusion to that effect is certainly not unreasonable. I just conclude at this point by saying that this court's observations in the Tenner case, Tenner v. Gilmore, which was cited by the state Supreme Court in adjudicating this claim, is very relevant. It's very applicable to this set of circumstances. These trial counsels were confronted with an incredibly difficult task of coming up with a guilt phase and penalty phase theory of trying to defend this client who had confessed once to his brother, once to police, gave details that showed that he employed three different methods of trying to kill this victim, went through. Dr. Koontz himself had to concede that he thought Stevens likely knew right from wrong when he was engaged in all of this extensive furtive activity post-crime. It seems a little bit of a stretch to present to a jury psychiatric testimony that says this individual dissociated and was, in essence, not at the controls when he committed this crime, when in the same breath, the psychiatrist is going to tell the jury, well, we can see that he knew what he was doing as he hid evidence of the crime. And then to also show that he is determining periods of dissociation by looking at whether petitioner seemed particularly focused when he was giving his confession, and then suggest that over the course of all of these activities and these repeated attempts, him walking away back and forth repeatedly from the room where Zachary lied, where he was initially rendered unconscious, to then decide to employ a trash bag after the fact and then suggest that this was dissociation. I think that under the circumstances, any means of proceeding in the penalty phase would have been at least as reasonable as presenting that theory. And as a final note, I would just say that Dr. Koontz himself is not without those in the scientific community that are skeptical of his theories about dissociative disorder. And to show the court what some of the sources of that dissension within the scientific community would be, I would just direct the court to his cross-examination, Dr. Koontz, in the post-conviction proceedings. I think that the Indiana Supreme Court's adjudication of this claim was very reasonable, and that these trial counsels did everything that they could under the circumstances to defend Mr. Stevens.
Before you go, on the issue of voluntary manslaughter, how did that preclude, using that issue, the preclude the testimony of Terry East, or was his name Tracy Easton, about the comment about that Stevens made as he was about to leave jail? He says, next time I'm going to kill the victim.
Your Honor, proceeding with the voluntary manslaughter theory without having mental health experts testify in the guilt phase and without Stevens, of course, testifying himself, which is something that counsel knew couldn't happen, there was no way for the state to introduce Easton's testimony on rebuttal from anything, and the door would not be open to evidence like that. So trial counsel was successful in not letting the jury be privy to that information until the penalty phase proceeding in that fashion.
Why would the mental health defense, I guess, have allowed that? Why would that have come in if they had put forth Kaplan or Koontz or somebody else that says something about disassociation or whatever it is?
Because if they're going to start offering testimony about his capacity to perform in particular ways, to his capacity to understand right from wrong, the quality and character of his actions, etc., that evidence would rebut that testimony to show that he consciously committed the acts.
In other words, it goes to his intent, his mens rea, his intent to do it, as opposed to something that removes him from the body. He can't exercise intent.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And this prediction, which is pretty accurate, actually, this prediction that the guy says, you'll be back in 2 months, he says, no, I won't, it's next time I'm going to kill my victim. That says he's leaving prison.
Correct, Your Honor.
Could have come in under this if they presented that defense, you're saying?
I'm sorry.
It could have come in, his testimony, Terry Easton.
Had they used the mental illness defense?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. The state would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does counsel have? 6 minutes.
I love that I can spread out. I have so many papers. If I may start at the end, right there where Mr. Martin left off. One of the questions Your Honor, that you had asked earlier had to do with the Indiana Supreme Court's, as a matter of fact, I think it's been asked maybe a couple of times about that post-conviction appeal, where the Indiana Supreme Court seems to kind of back off from their comments about the voluntary manslaughter choice of defense, and they seem a little more equivocal. One of the things that is very striking about their about the Indiana Supreme Court's ruling is that when they say that one or the other, they stress that if indeed mental illness had been brought in the guilt phase, that it would have opened the door to Tracy Easton's testimony, which had been successfully kept out on a motion in limine by defense counsel. However, what the Indiana Supreme Court does not say, and what the record does say, is that had the defense team been successful in getting a voluntary manslaughter instruction, that the prosecution was going to ask to reopen the case and put Tracy Easton on. And the reason is very similar to, as Mr. Martin indicated about the mental illness, it goes to intent. Because if indeed Mr. Stevens is putting on a voluntary manslaughter defense, he is obviously talking about sudden heat, passion, anger, such that it renders a person really unable to form that very specific intent. And so they would have, and they had told the court, they said, if you give them that instruction, then we're going to come back and we're going to ask you to let us put Easton on. So that's a red herring. That's a flaw. Either one of them would have opened the door. Either one of them would have had those consequences.
When you say either one of them, you mean either the mental illness defense or guilty but mentally ill,
yes, Your Honor,
or
that's what I meant.
Voluntary manslaughter.
Yes. Yeah. They both had the potential of opening that very same door, and so that was not that certainly was not a strategic reason not to use a mental health defense. Actually, there was no strategic reason not to use a mental health defense here. They didn't have enough information. They so prematurely, and after gaining little rudimentary nubs of information, made their decision.
How did they keep it out anyway?
Pardon me?
How did they keep it out then if all these other things would have allowed it to come in?
Well, I believe they, if I recall, and I may be recalling wrong, I think they kept it out under a 404B motion in limine as prior bad acts that were not relevant within the guilt phase. And the way they brought it in,
because he was in prison, and that would have indicated that,
yes,
he had a prior bad act. Therefore, because of the,
and I think that's primarily how they kept it out. And if indeed I am recalling that,
well, that
incorrectly,
makes,
I'm sorry.
I think that's correct, but yeah. I want to just delineate that.
Yeah, I think that's how they managed that. Yeah, because it would have certainly highlighted, and the prior at that point was not relevant. The prior only became relevant in penalty phase when they were talking about the probation aggravator, and that they brought Tracy Easton in to talk about that. And they also brought that statement in because the the state was very realistic that they had no concrete evidence that there had been a molest that had occurred when the killing had occurred, other than Christopher's statement, and the reliability of that was obviously questionable enough in their mind that they stated to the court that they needed, that's how they argued to get it in. They argued to the court that the case was weak enough they needed to bring Easton in order to corroborate what they felt was the intent. And it is important to understand, as I think we all do from reading this record, that the Christopher has never said that he said that. And another point, sort of a collateral point, but a very important one, is that supposedly there were two or three other people standing there, and according to Mr. Easton, and he could just never quite come up with their names. He could just never quite remember who else was there for that discussion. So the defense really never had an opportunity to try and find those other persons. That may have been different, but that's neither here nor there, because that's not important. I do want to point out, and I apologize that this is kind of hit and miss here. I was writing my notes down, but there was a point at which Baldwin said, Counsel Baldwin had said that he wished that there had been someone other than Linnett. And that's what also makes it so amazing that they did not seek another expert. And Counsel Clutter also said that if he had realized earlier on that Linnett ascribed to a myth of mental illness, that it would have made him very suspect as far as an expert for this particular case. I don't want to belabor this much, but I do want to point out, if I may, and this is certainly not the entire list, but some of the things that Kaplan and Coons had indicated that would have been available to work with. And I think we also need to bear in mind that whether or not dissociation would have, I see that my time is up.
Continue.
Okay. If whether or not dissociation would have resulted in an acquittal or it is not the issue. It is merely that we have something that is more than a negligible chance of a different outcome, and we so deeply believe that there would have been that chance. That the jury may well have wanted to put Christopher off the streets, I think that we can all understand that that's where our hearts go. But that's not what the issue is. There's a presumption of life. And had they chosen, had they investigated and given him a chance, he had no chance. He had no chance with the way he went to court. He may as well have gone by himself. And if I would just refer you to the brief, I will not take any more of your time. Page 19 has a beginning list of a number of diagnoses that could have been available.
I think we have
okay.
a point.
Thank you very much. We would respectfully ask this court to find that counsel had been ineffective and was prejudicial to Mr. Stevens, and we deeply appreciate your attention.
The court thanks both counsel for their excellent briefs in this case and for their very helpful oral arguments today. The matter will be taken under advisement, and the court will rise until tomorrow morning.